We're ready then for the third case, which is United States versus Guzman. United States versus Sample. 17-2086. Thank you, counsel. Counsel, we're ready to hear you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, your honors. My name is Fred Federici. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the District of New Mexico, and it is my great privilege and honor to speak to you today on behalf of the people of the United States. Your honors, Matthew Sample is a con man. He carried out not just one, but two sophisticated fraud schemes that spanned several years. He stole more than $1 million. But Matthew Sample walked out of the courtroom when he was sentenced without having to spend even a single day in prison. Instead, primarily because he had the means to pay, Sample was given a free fall to straight probation in the face of a guidelines prescribed sentence of 78 to 97 months imprisonment. In effect, Matthew Sample was able to buy his way out of a prison sentence. As your honors know, by statute, sentencing judges have to impose sentences that are sufficient to comply with the goals of Title 18, Section 3553A2. And while other factors, like restitution, are certainly required to be considered, by the terms of the statute, only the A2 factors are required to actually be sufficiently reflected or present in a defendant's final sentence. But the record shows that that didn't happen here, because the court abused its discretion in how it weighed almost all of the A2 factors, as well as some of the other factors. My intent this morning is to address each of the factors that the court wrongly weighed in more detail, but the quick summary is the court's findings that almost all of the A2 sentencing factors somehow supported a free fall to probation simply cannot be defended on this record. And in fact, we maintain that those findings are the polar opposite of what they should have been based on the record. And the specific A2 findings...
For comparative purposes, Mr. Federici, what cases can we compare to, or what guideline or what objective standard can you provide us to determine whether this is unreasonable from a substantive standpoint?
Well, Your Honor, I think the court's prior decisions in cases like the Morgan case or the Walker case provide the guidelines that the court should look to in terms of making its decision. And I think also specifically the statute itself. When we look to the A2 findings that were made, we don't believe that there was any support in the record for the court's findings with respect to the need for the sentence imposed to reflect the seriousness of the offense, to promote respect for the law, to provide just punishment for the offense, and to afford adequate deterrence to criminal conduct. Those, of course, Your Honor, are all factors that this court addressed in both the Walker decisions and the Morgan decisions, and found that the absence of those factors or the goals of sentencing not being reflected in the final sentence were enough to require that sentence to be reversed as being substantively unreasonable.
But those A2 factors are supposed to be informed by those other factors, right? Those other factors in A, and they include restitution. In other words, at least as I read the statute, yes, these two factors are ones that you look to, the A2 factors, in determining the sufficiency, but these other factors are supposed to inform your evaluation of those other two factors, I mean, the A2 factors. I mean, is that how you read the statute?
I don't know that that's that I read it completely that way, Your Honor. I think that those factors do have some independent standing on their own. I don't think that...
Well, they need to be... All right. Then tell me, how do you read the relationship between the A2 factors and the other factors that the statute says you should consider?
Well, I think, for example, when we look to... let me back up a step or two, I think. I think when we have a situation like the situation that's presented here, where we have the court having made specific findings under the A2 factors, for example, with respect to the seriousness of the offense, and we've got a finding that says that the seriousness of the offense plays in favor of a downward variance, that presents a problem independent of the remaining factors under 3553A.
Well, it presents a problem if you read into it. I mean, the point is, if the court says this supports a downward variance, and it does that by informing that factor by the importance of restitution, then those two things aren't necessarily inconsistent. I mean, the court can say, yes, these A2 factors are supported because I read the notion of I don't have the pull up the A2 factors right now, but I mean, the point would be that it would be informing those factors. So those things that's not inconsistent.
Well, Your Honor, I think it might be helpful and instructive for me to go through one of the factors that I'm talking about to sort of illustrate what I mean. So in pronouncing Mr. Sample's sentence, for example, the district court proclaimed that the seriousness of his crimes under 3553A2A weighed in favor of the free fall to probation. And yet, Mr. Sample himself has described his crimes as being abhorrent. He's described his crimes as being reprehensible. The district court found that his conduct was shameful. The district court said that Mr. Sample had earned the label of being a con man. So we think that what we had here was an investment advisor who abused his position to fund a $1 million lifestyle at the expense of his investors. So we believe that reading just the simple language of that A2 factor on its own, that it's beyond dispute on this record that Mr. Sample's crimes were serious. They were egregious.
I don't think anybody has to say that they aren't serious, but that doesn't mean that that's determinative, does it?
I think it may be, Your Honor, if the court makes a finding that's the opposite of what the facts will support. And I think that's what happened here. The court in this case found that the seriousness of Mr. Sample's crimes weighed in favor of a downward variance.
And we're supposed to be, well, if you read that in the context of his victims who said after being ripped off that I want to be paid back, then why doesn't that factor into the notion of what's serious or not? If the victims don't think it's so serious that their primary objective is not to have him go to jail, although one wanted him in jail typing out in some room, but the point is they wanted their money back. So I mean, so the point I'm making is part of your argument is sort of like an Ipsy Dixit argument. Well, it says serious, so what does serious mean? Well, serious has to have context. And if one's reading into what serious means, it's not self-evident that that's error. And even if the court weighed that too much, are we in the business of reweighing here?
Well, I think as the first part of Your Honor's question, with respect to the position of the victims,
would the trial court under that rationale have considered the matter more serious if the defendant had not paid the victims back?
Well, at the time of sentencing, the defendant had made partial restitution. He certainly hadn't paid the victims back. But under the rationale,
it had not made partial restitution, to use those terms then.
I think when we speak, when the statute under A2 speaks to the seriousness of the offense, it's speaking of the offense itself. And I don't believe
whether the restitution was made or not made would, from your perspective, not affect the seriousness at all.
Not that factor. I think that factor may play into the A7 factor, and that would be my partial response to Judge Holmes. In terms of the victim's position on restitution, of course, that matters. That, I think, goes into a different bucket, which would be the A7 bucket as opposed to the A2 bucket. And I do think that the reason that the statute's written the way it is not so that the A2 factors subsume all of the other factors outside of A2. I think that they stand and have separate independence and force on their own.
Well, if they stand in separate independent force on their own, then what do they do? I mean, part of the argument I hear from you is once we do A2, we're done. I mean, what relevance do those other factors have then? If they do not, if their purpose is not to inform the factors of A2.
Your Honor, I think I don't know that it's overstating that. I mean, our argument's more than that, but the fact that we believe we can show on this record that the court demonstrably got almost all of the A2 factors wrong means that the court misweighed those factors in a way that requires reversal in this case for substantive reasonableness. and that merely because the court may have looked to some other factors and put some weight on those factors doesn't change that overall balance. And in fact, Your Honor, I think Your Honor had said something similar to that effect in your concurrence in the Morgan case, which was in your closing, when you said, when the district court never properly examines factors that may militate against the chosen sentence, and when there is no other discernible basis for approving that sentence as reasonable, reversal and remand is our only option. And I think that that's the situation we have in this case.
Why don't you, I didn't see a response to the Gardinelli opinion, which is cited by Mr. Sample. How do you distinguish that case? There's a lot going on in that D.C. Circuit case. I mean, there's a lot going on in that case, but one of the things it talks about is that given the great discretion that the Supreme Court precedent gives to sentencing judges, that that the fact that one white-collar criminal gets a low sentence should not actually cut against general deterrence for another white-collar criminal. The idea being that, well, there's so much discretion anyway that I just may be the person who ends up getting the bad end of the stick, so I better conform my conduct accordingly. The bottom line being, if Mr. Sample got a light sentence, because of the breadth of the discretion, I can't be sure I won't, so I better do my thing the right way. That's one of the points that I got from Gardinelli. What's your response to that case? I didn't see it in your reply brief.
Your Honor, we concede that the breadth of discretion for district judges is very broad, but it's not limitless, and I think that's also a takeaway from Your Honor's cases, to include the Wittig decision, the Walker case, and, of course, the Morgan case. I don't think that answers the question. I think it sort of ducks the question to say, what's the limits to that rule?
Let me restate the question, the issue, just a little bit differently. What is it about this case, this sentence by Judge Herrera, that takes this case out of the area of broad discretion you've been discussing with Judge Holmes and puts it into the prohibited area of limitless?
I think the real takeaway for us here is the court's failure to properly weigh, in particular, the A2 factors. We look, for example, to another one, the court's finding that that when it proclaimed that the need to promote respect for the law under 3553A2A weighed in favor of a probationary sentence. That makes no sense on this record, where a licensed investment broker abused his position to steal more than $1 million. That probationary sentence in no way promotes respect for the law in the eyes of the public. I'd like to just touch on a few of the particulars on that point, and that is our point that the defendant's sentence is even more unreasonable than a sentence to straight probation would suggest, and that's because of what we've described as the breathtakingly permissive aspects of his terms of probation. And I want to be clear that that's not the main core of our argument. It's the challenge to the probationary sentence at all. But
I'm sorry, I need to ask you a question because I was looking through the brief and I couldn't find do you have a quote of what the judge said regarding the factor, particularly the factor of nature and circumstances of the offense? Or did the judge just say, I take into consideration all these factors and they weigh in favor of probation? Did the judge specifically say, I look at nature and circumstances of the offense, and after looking at that, I think that weighs in favor of probation?
I think the short answer is yes. The court specifically identified those provisions of A2 and A1 that we identify in our briefs, where we have said that the court got those wrong. The court specifically mentioned them, not with any type of elaboration, but did mention them.
Was it in a list of all of, I mean, was she just saying, I've considered the 8 factors and they weigh in favor of this? Was it a statement that could be construed as, overall, I think this weighs in favor? Or did she specifically go through each one and said, this factor weighs in favor of probation, this factor?
Your Honor, the court specifically identified each of the factors we've identified, without further elaboration and said that they supported a sentence of probation.
Okay, maybe Mr. Tuhig can
either save 11 seconds.
Thank you, Judge.
For a parting thought.
Do you happen to have that quote handy? No.
In my brief, I extensively quoted the judge's discussion specifically of the sentencing that she was about to do. And she addressed the seriousness of the offense with Mr. Sample, talking directly to him about it. I'm going to try to find the page. But it certainly is in my brief that I've talked about encouraging the court to read her full commentary on the sentencing, because this is not a judge who showed up in court and rubber-stamped the defense argument.
She did make some rather anomalous or draw some rather anomalous conclusions, correct? Like, this is a very serious offense, and therefore it warrants probation. What am I missing here?
I think what she's talking about, Your Honor, is the conditions of probation that are required in order to address what her primary goal was, which was restitution. After all, the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act plays into this. And even though the sentencing is under these guidelines, under this other statute.
Well, does that mean that the more you steal, the more you should, the more probation is warranted so that you can go out and work away mightily your sins so that you can earn money to pay the folks that you took the money from?
Of course not, Your Honor.
It seems to me that that's the logical premise of that argument.
What she was saying, though, Your Honor, is I've seen what Mr. Sample has done,
right,
what his behavior has been since these offenses were brought to light. I've seen how he's taken responsibility. I've seen how he's accepted what his obligation is, and I've seen what he's done. He didn't just go hide somewhere. He went out and got a job, not an easy job to get with those charges pending, and got a job where he would earn commissions, where the commissions would be substantial, would increase, where he had no fiduciary obligations, and in fact did the things that the judge referred to specifically in her sentencing discussion.
And why isn't that easily interpreted as him trying to buy himself out of jail? What happens to the defendant who didn't get an undergraduate degree from Duke and isn't able to sell like Mr. Sample? They just go to jail?
Your Honor, they have a much harder time making restitution whether in or out of jail.
Well, the point is Mr. Sample seems to be getting a break because he happens to be a talented guy, and he was a talented guy, stole $1.2 million. He was a talented guy. I mean, why should he be rewarded for that?
I don't see it as a reward, Your Honor.
He's not going to jail. That's a reward.
No, but he is working every day of his life trying to earn the money and working hard to earn the money in order to pay back his victims.
To pay back his victims, that's the operative point. I mean, he's paying back people that he shouldn't have taken money from to begin with.
Right? No question about that. I'm not here to debate that, Your Honor. I'm not even here to argue that he's innocent. I'm here to point out that the conduct that got him into this situation was conduct which is reprehensible and deserves punishment. And the district judge said the same thing.
And said, don't go out to fancy dinners. I mean, where's the punishment in that? I don't go out to fancy dinners. I'm not on probation. So, I mean, I don't get it.
She said that in response to the government's argument that he had done that. Her response was, we don't want to see you celebrating. We want to see you working and paying your victims back. That's what you need to be doing while you're on probation. She emphasized that to him. But, Your Honor, the restitution issue is not just about buying your way out of jail. I submit that buying your way out of jail would be if a millionaire wrote a check and said, here's the restitution. Now you don't have to punish me. He's punished every single day by having...
By the fact that he has to work hard?
Of course.
So the fact that he doesn't put the money in his own pocket but pays back people he shouldn't have stole from to begin with, he's being punished, right?
He is indeed.
Okay.
He's being punished by other restrictions as well. that the judge placed on him.
That he doesn't frolic off on personal vacations without notifying the probation office.
That he is required to basically spend all of his money on restitution.
Let me ask you this question. Why isn't this case, when I line it up against our Walker case, I have a hard time seeing much space between the two. I mean, I'm looking at this factor. It says the district court, and this is mostly a quote from the Walker, says the district court focused almost exclusively on Mr. Walker's newfound sobriety. We don't question materiality of this factor, but declining to impose any prison time, the court, quote, effectively failed to give any weight to the congressional values of the A2 factors. Why isn't that exactly what this case is? I mean, if I look at this transcript, the court says, no bones about it. I want to get the victims paid. You know, oh, no bones about it. This case is about restitution. I can talk about all this other stuff, but this is about restitution. Well-intentioned or not, why isn't that exactly what we said you could not do in Walker?
Your Honor, I didn't read Walker that way. I read.
Tell me. How do you read it?
Well, I read Walker to basically focus, and mind you, I haven't studied it as carefully as I'm sure the court did, but I read Walker to focus on other factors that could reasonably support leniency. But this was a repeat bank robber. This was the type of situation where there had to be a just punishment, and there was a recidivist history. If I remember Walker correctly, he was the sentencing, the court remanded it for resentencing, and he was resentenced to a period of incarceration in the district court. Your Honor, this is probation resulting from the need to satisfy the restitution obligation to the victims, which would not otherwise be satisfied. That wasn't Walker.
The guts of Walker, and this is what I would like you to respond to, the guts of Walker, as I see it, is that the court, as we identified in the opinion, focused on one thing, his sobriety. And that sobriety essentially made everything else essentially negligible, that every other sentencing factor, because that one thing was paramount. Well, if I look at Walker and I transpose it to the transcript in this case, this court said, the district court, to its credit, multiple times said, this is about money. This is about getting the victims their money back. When I look at their victim statements, they want their money back. And I'm going to, as a judge doing justice, I'm going to get their money back. And
Judge Holmes, what she said is, these are people who really need their money. Quote, if Sample didn't have his current job and current ability to make these payments, it might be doing something different. Which I think is the point that's troubling, if I may speak for my colleague, for the two of us. And I'd like to have your view on that. Are you saying that criminals who are not as well educated and who don't have financial means should get a stiffer sentence than those who are more privileged?
Of course not.
Or more thus privileged?
Of course not.
Of course that doesn't answer my question. I mean, we're dealing here with sentencing considerations that give guidance to the trial courts, and that's what judge said in this case. And is that commendable,
Your Honor?
From your standpoint, of course, you have to argue yes.
Well, sure.
That's you representing your client. But from a broader perspective of society, is that an appropriate standard to apply?
I think the question would be, if this court, if you, Your Honor, were doing the sentencing, would you apply that standard? Probably not. You might apply a completely different standard. But we're here on an abuse of discretion issue, and we're not here on a question of what an appropriate sentence is. We're here on a question of whether, like in Gall, where probation was ordered,
here to determine whether the sentence that was given was substantively reasonable.
Substantively reasonable, not procedurally unreasonable. And so if it's substantively reasonable, I submit, Your Honor, following the restitution obligation, considering the amount of restitution, looking at the picture of the victims, looking at the ability of the defendant to be able to, while he's on probation, earn enough to pay, while he's on a more restricted punitive probation, be able to earn enough to pay those people back? That's a big factor. That's,
so the mother,
it's also
who,
pretty
the mother
rare.
Who has children at home that are hungry and goes out and steals because she doesn't have an education to afford her the ability to earn money to feed those kids, this is extreme, of course, is going to be treated more harshly by the law than the banker who has a highfalutin degree and steals from his clients and is caught.
I don't see why, Your Honor. I think restitution is restitution. If she goes out and steals, whatever she steals, she should be obligated to pay for and pay it back. And she should put herself in a position to do so if she possibly can. And she should be encouraged to do that, as Mr. Sample was. And she should be recognized for doing so if she's able to do so. And I don't think this is a who has the money issue, who has the education issue. It's who went to work hard to take care of his obligations to the people he wronged.
And if this hypothetical person that Judge Lucero was referring to went to work hard at McDonald's and had a second job and therefore had been able to make only the slightest inroads into her restitution, wouldn't she be in jail? I mean, under Judge Herrera's view, because no, Judge Herrera said, you know, if you didn't have that job that you have, and she wasn't just talking about a job, she was talking about the job that generated that cash, you'd be in jail. So why would this hypothetical woman not be in jail? Because all she could get, the only job she could get, was to work at McDonald's. And say she worked two shifts at McDonald's, there's no way she's, I don't mean to disparage McDonald's, I'll be on the record, but the point I'm making is that's going to be a problem. Isn't it?
I don't see the problem, Your Honor. If she's working hard at McDonald's, if she's working two jobs, if she's paying back what she can afford to pay at the time of her sentencing, and she can continue to do that and hopefully pay back everything she took, then she would be a good candidate for probation under this same analysis. If it pleases the court, I think.
Let me ask you a question just so that I'm clear what your view is of this. One of the things that the court talked about in trying to balance it, I think recognizing what it was doing was somewhat out there, balance this is when it talked about the societal obligation, the fact that he did commit a crime to society, it talked about the notion of the restrictive probation terms. What do you view as the salient restrictive probation terms? And the reason I ask that in part is, at least my recollection is, house arrest. He didn't even get house arrest. I mean, he could have gotten house arrest such that he could have gone to work. He could have gone to whatever religious observance he wanted to go to. He could have done a bunch of stuff and then gone home. He got none of that. So what restrictive probation terms are we talking about?
We were talking about here, Your Honor, as restricted travel, restricted only for work, not for anything personal unless he had the specific permission of his probation office.
Keep talking about my life here. Play it out. Go ahead. No personal travel. What else?
Well, don't forget, he's basically a traveling salesman. And so he does travel. He's marketing these appraisals to banks.
But he gets to do those, right?
He has to do those in order to earn the money to make restitution.
Okay, so no personal travel. What else?
No personal travel. He can't have any earnings that he doesn't pay into restitution other than basic expenses of a level that were already established by the court.
Didn't the court let him keep his 401k? He didn't even have to tap that, right? He paid for educational expenses for I think his fiancée at the time, but he didn't have to tap that, right?
He had to tap the 401k both for his fiancée and to some extent for his legal expenses, rather.
But not to pay restitution to his victims. So in other words, when you were talking about restitution being paramount, it doesn't seem that he didn't even have to fully do that, did he?
The order did not require that. No, that's right.
Okay. What I was trying to hone in on was that the idea that you said this was restrictive, and I'm trying to understand from big picture point of view, what the most restrictive elements of this order are. That's my point. And so we've got no personal travel. We've got, you've got to pay every essentially discretionary dollar you have to the victims. Is that it?
I think there's a great deal more than that, Your Honor. You asked for the most restrictive.
I did.
But if you go back to Gall, the court there and in a couple of other probation cases talk about how probation is restrictive. You know, he doesn't just make a phone call to his probation officer. He's restricted. He had drug treatment. He's got to get approval for everything he does. Read the decision in Gall. I think sometimes we lawyers think being on probation is a lark, but
no,
it's
hard work. No, I don't think that at all.
Hard work.
All right.
Thank you, guys. Yes, I did want to take your time, but there's something in the record that sparked my interest. He got a $5,000 loan from a man named Cullen Davis. Can you tell me who Cullen Davis is?
Cullen Davis is an investor living in the Chicago area who has the same name as a rather famous person that you and I have read about and studied and whom I Googled and I saw. He was suspected of killing maybe two wives, if I'm not mistaken.
The richest man ever prosecuted for murder. Yes.
That is the story.
Okay, but that's not.
But that's totally unrelated. He tells me. Mr. Davis tells me. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Federici, you have a parting comment. That's all the time you got left.
Very, very briefly, page 73, Your Honor, addresses the restaurant comment. That was something the court came up with on its own, not in response to us. And, Your Honor, page 87 is the page that the court will want to look to in terms of finding, and this is in the second transcript, in terms of finding the court's pronouncements with regard to sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Counselor, excused. The case is submitted. As I said, the other cases are off on the briefs, et cetera, and so the court is in recess until tomorrow morning. The clerk.